Hey, welcome to the Morningstar Men's Weekly Podcast. If you're a regular follower of this podcast, you'll probably notice that we haven't been a weekly podcast for the last few weeks. So I want to quickly apologize for that. We are moving from the breakfast recordings directly to week three of the series Trustworthy. This week we're going to look at the topic of being engaged in relationships. This especially applies to relationships where you're committed to the relationship, but perhaps the other person is not quite as committed, and you're going through a rough patch in that relationship. What are some of the things that you do? Why is being engaged, regardless of the other party's commitment, why is your commitment so important? Is it fair? Is it right that you should have to remain committed, even when the other party isn't? Well, let's take a look at that this week. Okay, so a special thanks to Vinny and Mike for filling in for a couple of weeks. So a couple of things we're going to do just to tie everything together. I realize that all this stuff that we study is, well, it is theory at first. It's theory to all of us until we own it, until we start to implement it. But sometimes it's really hard to live something new that you learn. And I was just thinking about this last night. I'm prepping for this. I took a break, ran down to the Wawa, want to get a sandwich, come back. And keep in mind that the overarching theme of this trustworthy topic is to do with relationships. How to mend broken relationships, how to have more healthy relationships, how to improve the relationships that you already have. Well, I get there and I'm in a hurry. Well, Friday night at the Wawa is the wrong time to be in a hurry. I mean, it didn't take me but 30 seconds to be just flat out irritated with all the people there. And of course, I'm in the middle of trying to prepare material about how to be more effective in relationships. And it's just another reminder, as we all get so often, of how difficult it is to break the cycles of who we are and what we are and try to live differently. I met with Mike the other night. It's somewhere in your notes here, but I said, a lot of times life is like trying to drive your car and work on it at the same time. Right? You know it needs to be fixed, but you still have to use it. And that's the way it is with us. We know we need to be fixed, sort of. Fixed might be the wrong word, but we know that there's improvements that need to be made. But at the same time, we find ourselves living in the ruts and the traps and the everydayness of the life that in some ways has formed and squeezed us, right? We didn't create life. We didn't enter and custom engineer a life suited for us. But yet at the same time, unfortunately, over a period of years, we've sort of form-fitted life to us. Right, so you were born into a life, and life sort of molded you into its way, common expectations. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with those ways that it molded you. Waking up in the morning, going to work, those kinds of things, those are good moldings. But on the other hand, you've, over a period of years, sort of custom created your own life. And then you discover something new that you'd like to implement in your life. How long does it honestly take to create a new habit? I mean, if life were neutral, right, and there weren't things working against the creation of a new habit, it might be easy. But the problem with creating a new habit is you also have to break the old habit. It's not as if there was nothing going on. And so all of us have patterns of how we relate to each other. And as a matter of fact, not only do we have patterns about how we relate to each other, but over a period of time, we teach others how to relate to us. Don't go meet with him now. You can see it won't go well. Stay away from her right now. You can see what'll happen if you approach her now. We teach others how to relate to us. And so it's not just a matter of how do we, quote, fix ourselves, but then we have to allow time for others to start to learn about the new us that we've become, which isn't like the old us, and therefore they can expect something different from us. But there's a delicate wire that we walk there because if they still expect the same from us as we were before, then it helps us slip back into who we were before. For instance, have you ever vowed that you weren't going to do something again in a relationship and the right thing trips you and you're right back to where you were? Because we all have default modes that we respond. I'm not going to say any harsh words in this situation. I'm not. What does it take to push the right button so that you say the same thing all over again? And so it's not just the theory, it takes a long, long time to implement new patterns. So just hold that idea. Let's look at the next thing. And that is that of the number of topics that we're going to consider, so we've covered a couple so far. We've covered being stable. That was the first one. And then we've looked at how to be available. And we're going to look at one this week, how to be engaged, and then we're going to continue on. And of all these qualities that we're embracing under the umbrella of trustworthy, we're great at one or another of them. I believe every person in this room is already good at one or another of them, but we're all really bad at one or another of them. And that's the problem. And others know that we're bad at them. The only person who doesn't know that we're bad at them sometimes is us. Like, if you were to ask every person close to you, they might not use the same word, but they could tell you a lot about yourself. The problem is, they're the people that we're least likely to listen to, because there's friction in that encounter. And so, hopefully, we come to a safe place like this, where it's like, look, I don't care if you are that way. I don't have to relate to you every day, so it's okay if you're like that. But we all come to a place like this where we know that something inside of us isn't as we'd hoped it would be or would like it to be in the future. And so this is, I hope, a safe place where we can be honest about, okay, I think I could use some work in this area. All right, so there's a number of components that we're trying to implement each week. As we do that, let's start with this. There's three things that we need to do if we're going to change. So if there's anything in your life, especially anything in your relational life that you want to change, there's three components to it. The first is, we'll call it orientation. Where are you now? So once we describe a topic, so Vinny did, I assume, a wonderful job of dealing with the topic of stability, what you are as a human being, how stable you are. I'll do a little bit of review of that in a minute. But once he's done a great job of describing the quality, you have to discern, where am I? On a scale of 1 to 10, where am I honestly? That word honestly, that's a good one to insert there. Where am I honestly according to this quality? But orientation has two components. You ever used a GPS in your car? Get yourself from one place to another? And you plug in new coordinates where you want to go, or a new street address where you want to go, but you're stopped. So the little arrow is there, and it tells you where you are, but it really doesn't tell. Have you ever pulled out of a parking lot or somewhere and turned the wrong way because you weren't quite sure which way the GPS wanted you to go? Right. So orientation has two components. It's where I am, but it's also what direction I'm facing in. So the second component of this is who I am right now is, which direction am I actually interested in heading toward? So it's one thing to be a 5 on a scale of 1 through 10, but what if you're a 5 that's headed toward a 4? Or what if you're a 5 that's headed toward a 6? So orientation helps you discover where you are and also the interest you have in improving. Which brings us to the second component. Once you understand where you are, you have to be willing to take some action. The problem with action is that every action you take in order to improve yourself has to displace an existing habit or quality about yourself. Now, this would sound ridiculous if I were to ask you, show of hands, how many of you like yourself? But the truth is, if the only person in the room were you, and that question were asked, yeah, honestly, for the most part, we do like ourselves. The proof of that is we are the way we are. We've all had the opportunity to change. So there's something about the way we are and what we do and the way we do it that we like, and we like a lot. Otherwise, we'd be different already. So every action has to displace something in us that already is. So here's the question. What is it about the way I am that I prefer to the improvement that I'd like to make? You don't believe me, do you? You all think you'd really like to change. You desperately like to change. If you all want to change, if we all want to change so much, why is change so hard? Okay, don't we like what that proves that we like the way we are? It's hard work to do.
Change bad enough.
There we go.
It doesn't hurt enough yet. Right.
Which brings us to the final point, which is intensity of pursuit.
Have fun. Relationally, maybe a lot of people just don't think that they're broken. So Scripture says you are. Let's just take the most common relationship, our relationship with God. If you don't have Jesus, it's broken. I think even with some of myself, sometimes I feel like it's still broken. I'll use just that relationship because even though it, as one-sided as that relationship is, He loves me unconditionally. I really try to love back. You know what I mean? I guess relationships are so often a one-sided thing, it's hard to get that. Hard to get that moving. You know what I mean? It's like getting a ship underway. You got to floor it and floor it, and it's like, mm-hmm. and it just ekes out its, you know, thing. It's a challenge.
Let's separate two things. Sin on the one hand and knowledge / experience on the other. Because the first thing that happens when I tell you you're doing something wrong, right? What do? And I dig in my heels. If I tell you there's ways for you to improve and excel and get better at something, that's an invitation to improvement. So when we hear we're doing something wrong, okay, let's make it practical for those of us that are married. How does it feel when your wife tells you, in clear and uncertain terms, the number of things that you're doing wrong? I mean, just how do you receive that? Not, it would be nice if you would, but you always make a mess of that. How does that feel?
And you never, ever, ever, you never.
Well, we'll even remove the never and ever and all that, or always.
But those are the things, because what happens? It's always and never.
But what I want us to feel is the difference between you're doing something wrong versus you have an opportunity to improve. See, sin is you're doing something wrong, as opposed to an opportunity to improve. Do you expect the same level of relational intelligence from a 5-year-old as a 25-year-old? No. Well, we're all learning. Is it wrong for the 5-year-old to behave in certain ways? If all they have is a 5-year-old's knowledge of things, it may not be more than can be expected. That's what I'm saying. So please, when you hear something, don't dig in your heels and hear sin or not sin, right and wrong. Here, there is an opportunity for you to improve in something. Because it is just human nature, something about us, we'll call it pride, okay? That we just don't like it when we hear we have to change.
I don't think it's a coincidence. We're called children. God called us children. I don't think that's a coincidence. Nowhere does it call us adults. No, you're children. Why? But you act like children. First of all, you do something, dig in your heels, and you don't want to do it. No.
That sounds like a tweetable moment. Somebody should reduce that to a few characters and tweet that out. You want to repeat that for everybody? All right, so if you turn over to the back side of your first page, let's just walk through this. Unfortunately, this morning I suspect we're not going to get much past the theory component, but every week we're going to look at the theory, the concept, the knowledge part of the idea. Now, some of us have just never been completely aware of the fact that this is an important, whatever topic it is that we're going to look at, is an important component of mastering relational effectiveness. We just didn't know that. We never thought of it that way. So it's helpful to know something first. We'll spend a lot of time giving you knowledge. But with the knowledge is going to come, and we've already started to talk about this, your commitment to honestly say, where am I in relationship to this new thing? How much do I need to improve? So the whole time that we start to introduce the new topic, you have to be saying to yourself, how am I in relationship to this? The problem is this. We're not always good at accurately gauging ourselves. And so we all need somebody else that we might be able to talk this out with. Somebody that knows us well enough to actually know how we are, but yet we feel safe with. Now, as soon as you introduce that second component that we feel safe with, you eliminate 90% of the people. Right? There's plenty of people that know us. If I know you for 10 hours, I can pretty well discern a number of your qualities. If I get to know you for 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 working hours, I know a lot about you. But you may not trust me to speak into your life. So you have to have somebody that you know and somebody that you can trust. Here's the interesting thing. Do you have different friends for different circumstances? We do, don't we? You see why this is challenging? I have certain friends that I feel safe to talk about certain things with because I feel that they'd understand those things. But then I think, but if I shared this other thing with them, they'd either go glaze-eyed and wouldn't understand what I was talking about, or they've already revealed to me that they would have a judgmental attitude toward that, and I couldn't be open with them about that. And so it's really tough to find good friends for a variety of circumstances. Would you agree with that? It's half the battle, actually. But if we don't do that, most of us change more easily, more readily, when we're in a good relationship with somebody. Find somebody. All right, the next thing is the action plan. So let's say that you know that you know where you are, you'd like to make some improvements. Where are you going to start? And I mean, really, where are you going to start? What are the things that you're going to do differently? Have you ever been one of those New Year's resolution people? I mean, let's all just laugh about that for a minute and we'll move on. But have you ever been one of them? And what do inexperienced New Year's resolutions people do, right? The list is like that long, right? Be serious. You're not going to change three of them, let alone 30 of them. Let's just be honest here, okay? So when you put together an action plan, make it realistic. You're going to spend 10 minutes more. Okay, so let's say that one of the things that you discover is that you're not very approachable. And the component of approachability that you're not very approachable at is you're simply not available for people. It's not that you're distant from them, disconnected from them. Well, you're kind of distant from them because you're never in the same room that they are because you're always at work. So let's say that you discover that about yourself. What are you going to do? What would be a good action step? I'm trying to pick something easy.
Why are you always at work? Are you avoiding the house? Are you avoiding something at home? Or is it truly that there's just so much to do and nobody else can do it? I think that topic, it opens itself up for so many things. Well, if you're at work and you think that no one else can do it, you're in a bad way. You're there alone. Because there's always somebody else that can do it. If you're avoiding home because you just don't want to be home, you gotta really think about how you're going to tackle this because you have the other deep-seated things going on.
Don't go too deep into that. Did you hear what he just did? Identify why you're not doing something, and then you start to look at how you're going to address it. A lot of us have great intentions, but we don't have great follow-through. We get all inspired about how we're going to make some change in our life, but unless you have a practical understanding of how you're going to make that change and what's going to stand in the way, what happens? In a short period of time, you're frustrated, you give up, and you say, what's the use? This is just who I am. How many of us haven't at one time or another said, this is just who I am and the way I am?
That's lazy relationship. That's lazy. This is just who I am. That's all that there is.
Did any of us ever say that we weren't lazy?
Well,
okay, so now that you've confessed for all of us, thank you, let's move on.
But the thing is, frustration
with yourself, frustration with yourself.
Yeah. But a lot of people won't get into that. Half of what you're talking about is the inability to be honest with yourself. Inability. Absolute inability. You can't see it in the mirror.
And sometimes it's because we just feel down on ourselves. That's why I said, look at these as opportunities to improve. All right, so then you set some personal goals. So you got an action plan, but an action plan, apart from some goals, what is the specific thing that you want to accomplish? So the action plan is, okay, I'm going to come home 15 minutes earlier every day. That's a start. So if you don't set the goal, I'm going to take off one day a week. You're not going to do that. Don't create ridiculous action plans that you're never going to have any hope of following through on. Create small ones. Create small habits that you can change. If you've studied any about habit, you know that there are certain things, there's what they call keystone habits. And if you take a large habit, you can generally link small habits and associate them to it. So you take a big habit that's already in your life and you try to link small good habits to the big habit. All right, so what's the goal of this? Set some goal in mind that at the end of a year, the relationship is going to look different in this way. And then, what's your vision for the relationship? In the end, 2, 3, 4 years out. Because if you don't have a hope in your mind for how this... you already know how the relationship is. What is the vision that you have for 3 or 5 or 10 years out for how this relationship is going to look differently? I know there's an expectation factor built into that, and a lot of those things are outside of your control. But if you have no vision for how it's going to be, it's easier to slip back into the way things are.
You said put a red X 1 year out from now. What does it look like in a year? Put a red X 1 year out. You look at it in 10-year chunks. You'll never, it's too overwhelming. Don't look at it as, I'm going to be married for the rest of my life. How am I going to deal with her for the rest of my life? How am I going to deal with her today? Just today. How am I going to deal with her today? When I get home, I'm going to do my part. I'm going to leave on time. Come home. I'm going to decompress for 15 minutes, not 3 hours. And then I'm going to engage. Just today. Tomorrow might look different, but God, please help me to leave on time and engage when I come. And just prefer. And then, in a year, what's that look like? Take another inventory. In a year, what's that look like? I mean, our step studies go 9 months for a reason. Because we're looking at a huge change in somebody's life. And it takes 9 months to a year to make it happen. Work on one thing. Don't pick, you know what I mean? We say, pick one thing you really struggle with. Work on that one thing for a year. There should be a change in that. And if there's not, what?
Now remember what we've already talked about. As soon as you leave here, you're going back out into the life that you normally live. With all the expectations that are placed on you, with the way everything has been molded, the way you've custom crafted your own life, you are going back to the old you and your old life the second you leave here. So you have to be prepared for that. Remember what we said in the series where we were looking at the qualities that human beings needed? We said the character was that firewall that we build between the core of who we are and the external world so that our core doesn't allow us to spill out negatively into the exterior world, but also so that the exterior world doesn't implode our core. This is where character comes into play. So when you make a commitment to do something different, you're going to have to follow through on it. And everything is going to work against you at first.
That's why you need an accountability partner. You need at least one person who's going to say, hey, you're slack. You're not taking care of business. You're not, you know, you're slipping back into your old thing. Just one. You don't need a whole slew of people to tell you that. You just need one. Say, trust. Hey, you know what? Glad I saw you do this. I said, you're doing that thing again. What do you mean? Well, if you wanted me to tell you about, I saw it happen here and here and here this week. That's hard to hear, too.
It's hard to hear, but that's why I said choose people carefully. Choose someone you're going to want to listen to. There's people that you can hear that from, and there's people you just can't hear that from. You know what I'm saying already.
I said it Wednesday. Everything after, you know what you need? not everything after you need, they probably don't hear. But just like you suggested. Hey, you know what? I was just watching this week. Christ, and this is what I saw negatively this week in your advocate or in your parent. You're not bitter about it.
And the difficult thing is this. We don't want to open ourselves up and expose ourselves to that degree because we don't want people to think of ourselves as being anything. Look, I like everybody to think of me as being on top of my game. Who doesn't? Right? How many of us in the room want to think that everybody thinks we're a jerk? Right? No, of course not. We all want other people to believe that we have it under control. And so we try to live that way. You need to find somebody that you can, that's committed to growth too. Don't find somebody that's not committed to growth and be open and honest with them, because all they're going to do is say, you're right, you are. Fortunately, I have it all together. Let me see if I can help you. That's the last person that you want in your corner. No, it's not that funny. Yeah.
When someone comes to you with blah 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 blah, hands flailing, and man, you just diffuse that like it didn't even matter. How did you do that and not punch them right in the mouth? That was early recovery. That's what I had to ask. You know, well, maybe you know. Count to two. Just get to two. Don't try to count to ten. Just get to two. You know, so just early on, it's tough. And as we progress relationally, I don't think that life gets any better.
Right there is a core truth that everybody needs to embrace.
That was good.
Life is life, and life will always be life. Your ability, the ease with which you master life is dependent on what's going on inside of you, not what's happening out there. And that's why some people make life look easier than other people. Granted, there are different circumstances in life. There are circumstances that can impact that. But in general, everyone goes through one type of deep water or another. Everyone has relational challenges, financial challenges, whatever. Okay, a little bit of review, just so that we're knitting these topics together because they're so tightly related. So the first of these things is that I have to be stable in my relationships. I have to be stable. What does that mean? Anybody remember any of what Vinny would have introduced there? Well, let's see what Vinny introduced there.
Consistency.
That's good.
You know, one way one day, another way another day.
Is that an E or an A?
It don't matter.
We understand.
What else? That was a good all-around word to cover that. The word that I use, pretty much the same as predictable. I think that one does have an A in it. All right, that's a good list. Anybody want to add to it? So right there, you could take an inventory. When are you least stable? When was the last time you had a flare-up that made you out of character? How often are those flare-ups? What causes those flare-ups? Do you want to like co-teach this with me or what? That was funny, Jim.
Hey, I've had 30 years of this stuff, buddy. I got you, big parents. I know what's happening.
Okay, then we said the next component is approachable. What does that mean? There's a few components to approachability.
You're not judgmental.
Okay. All right.
You listen well.
Listener.
Bring me more of that.
If you're not consistent in the way you act, nobody's going to approach you. They're not going to know how you're going to react.
And that's why these are all interconnected. And that's why our relationships can be hijacked by any one of these qualities being a little bit out of whack. So for sure, you can be stable in all the wrong ways, right? Just like Jim said, that flare-up might not be out of character, it might be the way you are. So you can be stable in a negative way. But you can also be approachable one moment and yet not approachable the next. So you need to bring both of these to the equation. And so here's what we're going to say. This top one creates an atmosphere for relationships. You might actually want to write that in your notes. If you want to create an environment in which relationships can live, let's say a biosphere, if you want to create a relationosphere, then it is your stability that makes that possible. Now this approachability factor applies when people want to come to you, when people are interested in engaging with you. We struggle with this a lot when maybe they're more interested in relationship than we are, or they're more concerned with problems than we are.
Well, if you look at that, the stable part is sort of that outer wall. You know what I mean? And it's really stable, but you're not sure why. All of that stuff on the approachable part, that's the inside part. Because I didn't even know how to work on consistent, predictable, independent. But I know how to work on gentle. Because you can be consistent in any number of different ways. But gentle is gentle. Here, on another planet, no matter where you are, gentle is gentle. Receptive. Listening is listening. It's you not talking. It's something that I can work on. If someone else is talking, you're not talking over top of it. On Wednesday night, somebody sat right there in that chair, and their kid was going, wah, 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 wah. And they said, man, he talks over the top of people. I said, yeah, I wonder why. Because you did the same thing, you know? And so, it's funny because their countenance changed, and they're like, wow, you know what? Yeah. But I don't know what to do about that. It's easy. Wait, no, it's simple.
Yeah, it might not be easy. Okay.
You know what I mean? But those things down there, you have to work on. And they bring the top. They'll bring the top, I guarantee you.
All right, so if does everybody have these written down if you want to write them down? And if you don't, that's fine too. So what we said is this creates the environment in which a relationship can exist, because you can have a predictable, consistent relationship with someone. If you're one way one day and completely different the next, they never know who they're going to meet. This has to do with them being interested in relating to you. Now today we're going to look at what happens when you're interested in the relationship, or perhaps you feel the relationship is falling apart and the other person doesn't really care. So, I've used three words to describe that: engaged, involved, and committed. The other day I was listening to some, I don't know if I should confess this, I was listening to country music. You won't hate me too much for that, will you? Well, anyway, so here's this quote from Casey Musgraves. Love, it's crazy that someone who gives you so much and fills you with joy can then take it all away and wreck you. All right, so have you ever experienced that? Someone who brings joy and happiness into your life, who brings meaning and contentment and satisfaction into your life, and then a month later, whatever they're doing, it seems to be sucking all of that right back out of you.
Or have you gone the other way with that? If you had something in your life that was awesome, that was great, and then they went right out and it didn't wreck you at all, you were actually okay. You dealt with it in a healthy way, not like a 5-year-old or not like a 12-year-old. You dealt with it in an adult way. Because there's two different ways to deal with it, right? There's this way, which, like they said, is, you know, it wrecks you. Does it have to wreck you? What if you were so stable and that, you know what, that happens, it's cool.
Well, I think when we're talking about here a specific kind of relationship, okay? Let's say a relationship that has become a covenant relationship. Okay, so let's say that it is a marriage. All right? So now we've been in this marriage together for 10 or 15 years, and one day this other person, and it's not as if the symptoms and the warning signs perhaps weren't there for years. Maybe you didn't notice it. Maybe you tried. Maybe the other person has something else going on. And so one day they're just done with it and they walk out.
That's different.
We're not talking about the relationship you find at the bottom of a Cracker Jack box and it was a free prize and then you can discard it later. We're talking about something that's more, or a parent-child relationship where there's a lot invested in it and then they're just done with it.
And it happens, it's not like you have this long, slow taper off. It comes to the cliff and whack, smack you in the face.
And when we introduced this at breakfast, we used as a backdrop, sort of run in the background story, the prodigal son story, right? Do we know from the story, which has very few details, was there anything building up to it? We don't know. Possibly the father could see some telltale signs. The younger son wasn't as engaged, wasn't as interested, kind of looking off on the horizon more than he was looking at the plants in the field, whatever it was. There was probably some telltale signs, but one day he was just done with it. And the reason I introduced that quote was, when you're in a covenant relationship, you have vowed to be engaged permanently. But you've also, and I don't want to step on what John's going to do in a couple of weeks, John's going to lead us through the personal topic, but you've also given a piece of who you are to that relationship. So when that person leaves, what happens to that piece of you that is with them? Do you see what I'm saying? And so it sets itself up naturally for the fact that we become bitter if we're not careful. They've taken a piece of who we are. I've given something of value, of myself, into that relationship, and they've left with it.
Because also, if it's a covenant relationship, you've grown together. You know, you've built that from what you were. You know, marriage. You were saying before. So now if it's marriage, you're moving forward. You have changed a habit of being single, of whatever that might be, and you still this. And you do. You lose a piece that you have no control of getting back. You know, and that's the piece. And it's a valuable piece because it's what you've become together. Same thing with the same thing with kids. You know, you're building, you know, they say no matter what else you build, grow, do, the only thing really behind is your kids, is your kids. Because you know, leave job to whatever else, they all belong. That's your legacy. And you're trying to build that. And that's tough because that's you, that's your responsibility.
So I want to look at three stressors. So the two people are in relationship. There are three things, see you, Jim? So we're going to look at each person in the relationship as a vessel. So the first of the stressors is experienced by only one. We'll say it's outside. Just thinking about this a little bit this week. All right, so two people are in a relationship with each other. And let's take something that's kind of personal. So let's make it husband and wife, just for ease of illustration purposes. And one or the other loses a parent. Now, the other person probably isn't quite as deeply tied. So let's say it's the wife that loses a parent and the husband's here. And the wife is feeling a huge amount of pressure there. It wasn't your parent, and while you probably have grown to love that person, there may not be quite the same amount of pressure. So how do you manage the relationship then? How do you remain engaged then? Okay, so the next one is, we have an internal, commonly experienced pressure. Same relationship, we lose a child. Okay? Now the weight is borne equally by both people, we assume. You see the difference there? And so we both understand it, but we still may process it differently. But here's the really challenging one. What happens, same relationship, remember the first one experiences loss, the other one doesn't experience it quite the same way, and so we have to figure out how to relate there. The other one, they both experience loss together, so we have to figure out how to process it together. Here's the other one. What happens when I am the pressure in the other person? Or they are the pressure in me? What happens when my dissatisfaction with you is what's putting the greatest amount of pressure on my life? And what do we do with that? Now, here's the interesting thing. Sometimes the people that we find it easiest to get along with are the people that we can escape from. We don't have a great deal of tie and commitment to them. You have friends you meet with once a week, every couple of weeks, you hang out with them, you have a few laughs, you talk a little life, you do whatever you do. You might even share some deep stuff, but then you go home to your own life. You have anybody like that? Of course you do. How many of you have been in a relationship for at least 10 years? Some sort of long-standing relationship. All right. Have you ever noticed how the longer you're in relationship with somebody, the more things you find about them that annoy you? Okay, at least people at this table apparently noticed that. What do we do with that? See, it's amusing when you say it. It's not so amusing. Annoy was a really polite word, too, incidentally. Was it not? Yeah. Annoy is not the word that I would really like to have used. But given the circumstances and the setting, it's probably inappropriate to use all those other words.
You are recording.
Good point. What do we do with that? And what happens when we don't have some way to work this out? So here's what I started to think about. Do we need some means of relational dialysis? Do you know what I mean? Like toxins build up in you, and what do you do with that? Your kidneys are supposed to handle all that, but when your kidneys aren't working right, what do? Well, you don't, but you go get plugged into a machine, and then, well, actually, I guess they've developed these dialysis at home things, so you can plug yourself in, so I guess you can do that. But anyway, you have a way to remove the toxins. Do we have a way to remove relational toxins that build up in our systems? Because if we don't, what happens? What do you do with someone that you're in a covenant relationship with, but with each passing day, the pressure is pushing down further and further? Further and further and further, and there's more and more and more about them that annoys you, and less and less and less about them that brings you joy and satisfaction, and yet you're supposed to be committed for life. What do you do with that?
You either blow up and relieve the pressure, or you need to eat. Thank you.
Now, if we had, and I wish I had multiple boards to do this with, but do you see why being approachable matters? Because if you're not approachable, when this person is experiencing the pressure that they feel is coming from you, and they go to you, and they say, this is what's happening in my life, and you say, well, no, it's not. I'm not doing that. Or, well, it's not that big a deal. Or, just get over it. Or, well, I don't know. You tell me. What do they say? You said you've been in relationships for at least 10 years. What do they say? Okay, so we have another R-rated conversation that can't take place here.
Well, these are all about learning how to process each of those things. Like my wife has told me that in years past, we couldn't talk about this, and it's so nice to know that, one, you're not going to punch somebody, you're not going to punch a wall. Learning to have those relationships outside of these ones where I can go and I have given somebody the authority to speak in my life that, hey, you know what, you're really not thinking right about that. Let me ask you to consider a different viewpoint.
He used a critical word there. Please remember what you were going to say. He used a critical word there, we learn. None of us is born with these skills. As a matter of fact, we grow up, and as we're growing up, all of our relationships have some level of authority over us. Right? All the covenant relationships in our life, when we are young, have some sort of authority over us. And then we mature, and they pretty soon become peer-to-peer relationships, and we don't know how to do peer-to-peer covenant relationships well. We have to learn how. So, and the first thing is that people think, especially when they get married, it should just all work itself out. Nothing in marriage works itself out for the better. Just works itself out by accident. There are no accidental improvements in marriage. There are many accidental deteriorations, but there are very few accidental improvements. I mean, unless you accidentally won the lottery and brought that money home to your wife, there are no accidental improvements. Ron?
I was going to say, you know, everybody's different. You get some people get in that situation, and they'll deal with it by running away. You get some people that will sit there and even fester for their whole lives. You get some people that will learn to interact over time and deal with it. Work it out.
Last week, Mike mentioned a book called The Five Love Languages. My wife read that a while ago, and she started using that in our conversations, and it became really important to us because we started realizing, like, okay, one thing is more important to you and another thing is more important to me. We have to, if we're going to make this work, we have to figure out how to find some middle ground with, you know, what's important to you and what's important to me. Hey, these different, you know, openly talk about it. My father-in-law put it this way. He said, especially if you're Christians, Jesus tells the Holy Spirit will come live within you. And the Holy Spirit shouldn't be butting heads with itself, right? So that's our humanness getting in the way. So if there's something getting in the way, you can't be foolish and be like, no, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm not doing that. I'm not causing that pressure. You have to be willing to learn instead of thinking you know it all and you have it all together. So you really have to be
I remember a younger me and feeling that somehow when my wife wanted certain things or asked certain things of me, that somehow doing that would make me untrue to myself because it felt unnatural to me. It just wasn't the way I was wired and the way I was. And what you're saying is, this is why growth is sometimes painful. Right, we all love growth that's easy, or growth that doesn't produce some sort of cutting away. But sometimes, in order for growth to take place, something has to be cut out of the way that's there already. But sometimes we need to die to small pieces of who we used to be so that we can become something more for the relationships that we said we want most. All right, let's turn over to Jeremiah, the 17th chapter. We're going to start at the 5th verse. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man, who makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. Now, when we hear that word cursed, it sounds as if God is invoking this curse on us. But what I'd like us to do is look at this a little differently. Minus the blessing of God, minus the help and the assistance of God, is the man who trusts in flesh. Here's what this is really saying. You can choose to put all the eggs that you have in the basket of the other human being. You can trust them. When you get into a marriage relationship, one of the things that makes it unusually difficult is that there's mutual dependency. I have some needs and some expectations that I'm counting on you to meet. You have the same from me. We're expecting things from each other. The reason that your outside friendships are easier to maintain is because the amount that you expect from those relationships is lower. Any relationship where there is a great deal of expectation between the parties, it's ultimately going to break down. There's going to be problems. Not, it doesn't have to break down, but there's wear points, there's stress points.
Jeremiah 17.
So again, cursed is a man who trusts in man, who makes flesh his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. And look at what it says. And remember, don't view this word cursed as God just heaping bad stuff on. Look at it as this man or this woman is choosing to live outside the blessing of God by depending on other people first and God secondarily, if at all. He is like a shrub in the desert and shall not see any good come. He shall dwell in the parched places of the wilderness in an uninhabited salt land. Okay, so there was something planted there. The shrub had started out to live. But over a period of time, because there is nothing to nourish it, it starts to wither. So here's a different way of describing it in relationship. When you're expecting the other person to do all of your nourishing for you, you're going to be disappointed. But when you're expecting to get nourished from God first and then be able to give into the relationship or receive from the relationship as the secondary cause to help you, you're in better shape. Why would anyone voluntarily set themselves up to be the shrub in the dry land? That's the question. But when we count on the other person in this critical relationship, when we count on them first and God only second, we're guaranteed to have heartbreak at one point or another. Let's move on. Blessed is a man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is in the Lord. Now that's said two ways for a reason. Trust in the Lord, that's active and present tense, whose trust in the Lord is a mindset. So my mindset is, generally speaking, I look to God and trust in God, but my present tense, active in the moment commitment is, in this moment I am trusting in God. How many of us trust in God? How many of you have ever not trusted in God first? That's what this is saying. There is a mindset, a general predisposition to trusting God, generally speaking, but you're blessed if your mindset is to trust God and your action in the moment is also to trust God. He is like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream and does not fear when the heat comes. For its leaves remain green, and it's not anxious in the year of drought, for it does not cease to bear fruit. I must have read that about 24 times this week. It's really so good. How many of us are looking to other things to be our primary emotional and intellectual nourishment? Right? And what it's saying is, plug yourself into God and God's promises and He'll take care of nourishing you. And I know that sounds so cheesy and we expect to hear that answer in church, but do we really put it to the test? Do we really find out, or do we just say, oh, that sounds like the answer you would get in church? Next, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? And then this verse 10, which I love. I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind and give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. Now it goes on to describe a particular circumstance after that. But what if instead of viewing this as God giving people what they deserve, right? And if God gave us all what we deserve, well, we wouldn't be here, right? So there's got to be more to this verse than that. What if God is testing and searching the heart, and the person who is plugged into God, whose roots have grown down deep into God, God is testing that heart and saying, he needs a little help here. He needs some support there. I think I need to speak into his life here, and it will help him. So what if instead of us viewing that verse as saying God is testing me and trying me to find what's wrong with me, God is saying, I'm testing you and trying you to see where you need some help because I'm going to give you nourishment, that water, right where you need it. All right. Let's turn over to... Great couple of stories here. Very helpful stories. So... a few years ago, there was a group of industrial psychologists, we'll call them, right? They study how people work in the workplace and what keeps people active and engaged. So they were tasked with studying call center people, You know what a call center is? It's that place where you call when something's wrong with your credit card or when something isn't working right, and someone in a semi-foreign language talks to you in an accent that you can't quite understand, and you thought you pressed the for English press one button, but it seems that you got for Bangladeshis, you got that one. You know, so we're all familiar with call centers, right? All right. It costs a lot of money, comparatively speaking, to train someone to work in a call center. I know we don't believe this, but it really does. They really are trained. And so obviously, if you've invested as a company, if you've invested time and effort in training someone, you want them to stay around. And yet what they were finding is that a typical call center person was lasting less than a year in their job. 9 months was an average stay. And they were asked, can you guys figure out maybe, are there some indicators that would help us to understand who were the likely people? And they're searching and they're searching and they're searching. And somebody made this accidental discovery that had to do with what internet browser they used. And they noticed this thoroughly by accident. And it seemed that, all right, there were call center people who would either use Internet Explorer if it was a Microsoft thing, or they would use Safari if it was an Apple thing. And then there were other people who would use a browser like Firefox. And it turned out that the people who used a browser like Firefox or Google Chrome, they tended to stay in their work longer. They said, what in the world is up with this? And they put it to the test, and they did it at call center after call center, and sure enough, where there was any discretionary power, and people could opt for whatever internet browser they wanted on their personal workstation at work, wherever they found these optional ones, there was a higher rate of staying. And what it turned out is, Internet Explorer is default. Safari is default. You don't have to do a thing to have that on your computer. It comes on your computer. It was the little things that these people did to make their workstation their own and to personalize it that made all the difference in their work commitment and their work satisfaction. So here's the question to take away from this. What things are you just letting to default in your relationships and assuming that they'll work out? And have you been willing to take any small creative risks to do something different or outside the normal or unusual to try to make the relationship work more? And you know why the people didn't want to risk something? They were afraid that something might go wrong. Listen, there's enough going to go wrong by default in all of our relationships. Wouldn't it be worth taking a few small risks to try to do something that you've never done before to make the relationship better? And just to double down on this, the next story. Another group of people, they studied young child prodigies. Those are those kids that, you know, at 5 years old, they do what your 15-year-old wishes he could. You know the kind of kid I'm talking about. And what would you think? Wouldn't you think that young kids that are like this, they would go on to change the world? They would be the best, the most brilliant, the brightest? Well, here's what they found out. Doing a study of these young and extremely gifted kids, these kids tend to master the status quo. If it already exists, they do it well. If it already exists, they try to excel at it. They get every note right. They get every word right. They never make a mistake at anything. They do the status quo better than anybody else can do it. Counter that with the kids who were sometimes in the lower percentiles of their class were freer to make mistakes, were more comfortable with making mistakes, thought, well, mistakes are pretty normal. Those kids actually went out more often and did something revolutionary that made a significant change in the world because at an early age they became comfortable with making mistakes and rebounding after they made them, as opposed to the prodigies that were locked in a sense of fear because they couldn't do one note wrong. What are we willing to risk in order to improve a relationship? Let's turn over to Deuteronomy. All right, we're going to start at 30th chapter, 11th verse. I know you've all seen these words countless times. For this commandment I have commanded you today, and it is not too hard for you, neither is it far off, it is not in heaven, that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? Neither is it beyond the sea, that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth, it is in your heart, so that you can do it. See, I have set before you today life and death, good and evil. And here's where we get to the part that I want us to focus on. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in His ways, and by keeping His commandments and statutes and its rules, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering in to possess. All right, so we look at the end result of this. Is God blesses, they prosper. Is that what we want in our relationships? I assume the answer is yes, that's what we want, as opposed to the opposite of that, which doesn't sound much fun. So we all want the good result in the end. That's what we're agreeing to. Now look at the way he says, if you want, so let's reverse engineer this and say, if you want the good result in the end, what do you have to do up front in order to get the good result in the end? So it starts out with, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I have commanded you today. Now that seems common sense, right? That seems like the typical church answer. I do what God wants, what makes God happy, and I get something out of it. But that, interestingly enough, is not really where it starts out. It says, if you obey God's commandments that I give you today, and look at what it says first, by loving the Lord your God. That's the first thing it says. It doesn't say do what God said first. It says love God first. If I love God, it's easier to obey His commandments. If I don't love God, obeying any of God's commandments is really a burden and a chore. So when we take this and we transfer it into relationships, my commitment toward the other person, if I have that commitment toward the other person, then doing these other things for the other person is easier. But if I start first by thinking I got to do this stuff to make so-and-so happy, and then maybe they'll love me back, what happens? What happens when we have to do chores that we hate to do? We find ways to procrastinate, do we not?
Bad attitudes.
I found this interesting when I read this. That it all starts out with your commitment to love God. Now, some of us struggle with what does it look like to love God? And exactly how do we love God? But have you ever struggled with how do I love my wife? Or how do I love my kids? Or how do I love a good friend that I'm really covenant relationship with? There are a handful of friends I believe that we should be in some sort of covenant relationship. I'm with you, you're with me, we're doing life together. What does it look like to love them? And then out of that, we become for them what they need from us to the best of our ability. So love, then walk in His ways, and keep His commandments. And those three words, I'd like us to just bore down on them. You love first, you walk with the other person. In other words, you're in ongoing relationship. Love first, walk with, and then finally, keep, which is observe some of the things. Do those people that you're in relationship have some expectations for you? We know they do, right? You have expectations for the people that you're in relationship with. They have expectations for you. If we start out with the expectations first, we're doomed to fail. Love first, walk alongside next, finally and lastly, meet the expectations. If we try to do it in any other order, it's not going to go as well. So that's just a tip for you. All right. Because we don't have a lot of time left, let's do a couple of things. If we want to be, let's just go to the bottom of the last page there. If we want to be committed, long-term, and engaged. And here's the assumption that I am making. There are times in every covenant relationship where you're going to be tempted to give up, especially if the other person has already given up. There are times when you're just going to want to move on to the next season in life and leave them behind. There are times when the reason for that is because that other person has wounded you. You know, the interesting thing is the people that can wound you the most are the people that you've allowed to get the closest to you. Right? You don't care if somebody that you never met before calls you an idiot. Well, I mean, you might care, but you don't care at the same depth. But if your wife calls you an idiot, maybe it wounds a little more. Or then again, maybe it's so common practice that it no longer bothers you. But you know what I'm saying. So, care for yourself first, so that you don't become bitter. This gets back to this plugging yourself into God first. Have you ever had an important discussion with someone close to you before you were prepared? You just sort of rushed into the discussion. We need to have this talk, and we need to have it now because we're going to get something worked out. Apparently, I am the only one in the room who has ever had that. When I'm not in the right place with the right attitude, I've started out with two strikes, at least, against me before I even go into there. And I certainly haven't given them time to prepare, because the truth is I wanted to ambush them with my brilliance. How does that go? I mean, it turns out when you try to ambush the natives that they have weapons of their own and they strike back. Right, so what was going to be a confrontation that was going to bring resolution, a half an hour later has become entertainment for the next door neighbors because they can clearly hear it. As a matter of fact, they can hear it all the way down the block. And nothing is resolved. Spend some time preparing yourself first.
We go the other way too. Or we know there's something we need to talk about, we decide not to. Not that we are working through forgiveness or amends or anything like that. We just decide we're not going to address it. We end up with an elephant in a room nobody wants to talk about. Over and over and over again.
All part of that preparation thing, I think.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of us are naturally combative. Right? I mean, you've all heard the fight or flight thing. They say there's actually three things: fight, flight, or hide. That's what camouflage is all about. Okay, so that's the third thing. So you try to make yourself invisible in those bad situations. And you know what I'm talking about. So some of us are naturally confrontational. If something comes up in a relationship, we're just going to deal with it. Right? And as a matter of fact, if the other person is a flight sort of a person, we're going to deal with it if we have to chase them from room to room to room around the house until we get resolution. Okay, two hide people, what do they do? Or flight people, what do? They just run in opposite directions. They're never home together. Two fight people, well, we've already covered what they do. I love what John said about if the Spirit of God lives inside of me and the Spirit of God lives inside my mate, does the Spirit of God fight with itself? Now, interesting, does the Spirit of God have active and dynamic conversations? Probably. But is the Spirit of God at enmity with itself? Of course not. Okay, next point, so we can get through these pretty quickly here. When there is relational separation, okay, we'll come back to the prodigal son, what do you do? Work on yourself while you're waiting for the other person. When we have great expectations for what the other person should do, we're inevitably going to be disappointed, which ties into one of the other things: expect people to be themselves. You ever expected people to behave out of character? You know, if they've behaved this way for the last 20 years, chances are this is not the year they're going to be different. If they behave this way for 20 years, chances are in year 21, they're probably going to be mostly the same way. There's only one thing that is going to keep the relationship alive and active and actually improve it, and that's if you work on you. And I know most of us would just like to get in there and tinker with the settings on the other person. If there was only that setting, if you could just push a few buttons and it would be different. And I can tell he's looked for that place and it doesn't exist, does it? Work on yourself. I mean, what if you were, what if we set it up as a challenge? What if we said, you know, if the difficult relationships in your life remain difficult, what is it about you that you can't seem to master that's making them difficult? So we usually focus on the other person, if they could just be think more like I do, be more like I am, whatever it is. But what if we set it around the other way and we said, if the difficult relationships in our lives are still difficult after years, what is it about ourselves that we refuse to change or master or upgrade or improve? And I don't want to make it negative either. You know, when we talk about getting into the Word, don't just get into the Word to memorize Scripture for the sake of memorizing Scripture the way it is. Unpack it and say, what would it look like for an intelligent, creative person? Let me underscore those two words. What would it look like for an intelligent and creative person in the 21st century to apply that Word and make it come alive in this relationship?
That's where the slippery slope.
I understand what you're saying, but let's take it outside of a marriage relationship.
Okay.
Remember, we're committed to the relationship. We're going to call it a covenant relationship. Now, I'm not saying that work is a covenant relationship, but let's say you need the job that you have. Let's just hypothetically say that this job is the job that you want, you need, pays you well, provides for all of your needs, but there's a challenging relationship in that job. You can either continue to go through hell a day at a time in that job, even though it's paying you well, or you can try to figure out ways in which you can rise to a higher level and in that be able to find some level of contentment and satisfaction in the work, even though it's difficult. So if you continued, we've all heard that statement. I think it was Einstein who said it, that problems can't be solved at the same level that they were created, right? Well, imagine that in relationships, that problems can't be solved at the same level at which they were created. So what we're saying is, perhaps I need to elevate my understanding and my capability to a different level so that I can relate to this person at a different level. And that will invite them up to the higher level as well. John.
Alex Pender played his movie, we say things we don't need to.
Right. And for her, operating at a higher level ended up being, what can I do to serve my husband? Which would be the exact opposite of what you would expect. Instead of saying, what does my husband need to do to fix this? She went to the next level and said, how can I, even the way he is, serve him where he is? And she had a different understanding about herself as she started, yeah, I have some flaws, I have some brokenness in my own life. That's the higher level that they ended up operating at.
I think that's where you're at. That was going to talk
about. All right.
It's really, it's good.
One final point here. Believe that you can create change. In other words, you can be the catalyst for change. You can't necessarily create the change, but you can be the facilitator and the catalyst for the change, but expect that the change is going to be harder and take longer. And that is where people give up. They're committed to change. They're even committed to changing themselves so that they can facilitate change in the relationship. But it proves to take a lot longer than they expected. It proves to be a lot harder. And somewhere along the line, they give up and they say, what's the use? And they move on. So if we adapt that phrase that is used again and again, I think it was Robert Schuller coined it years ago, what would you do if you thought that it wasn't impossible? What change would you commit to and work toward if you knew it were possible, but you didn't know when you were going to get there? So I'm going to leave us with that.